For the week of January 14th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 395, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. And let us, at the top of the show, make clear we are not going to merge with Viacom.
No, we are not. Absolutely. Not even if they asked, by the way.
Talks are off.
Yes. Are we alone in that, by the way?
No, talks are on with Viacom and CBS merging, or is that re-merging, I guess?
Didn't they get divorced? Is Viacom kind of like,
Elizabeth Taylor.
I was just going to say that.
Corporations, yeah.
So a couple of years ago, 2011, I believe it was, Viacom and CBS broke up because everybody thought, well, CBS can make so much more money and be worth more on its own.
And they were right.
CBS, you know, the shares have skyrocketed. Meanwhile, you have Viacom, who is out there with Paramount Pictures going, you mean we're supposed to make movies? Huh. Interesting. Because they have nothing on the horizon. And they've had some management shakeup and issues over there. And now it looks like, Sherry Lansing, the daughter of Sumner Redstone. Did I say Sherry Lansing? It should be.
You did indeed.
Sherry Redstone.
What? Wow, you're really well prepared for this week's show, Sperling, and it took all day for us to record.
That's true. And by the way, the reason it took all day is because they are doing construction right outside the studio here. So if you hear something, it's because despite the soundproofing, we're in a makeshift studio while they do construction in the main studio.
So it's not that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like Leatherface, is not coming for you. That's just a high-pitched chainsaw in the background, staying in the background.
It may be both, but I'm going to go with the latter.
Let's hope so. We did have some breaking news that the lead singer of the Cranberries, Dolores O'Riordan, died at 46. We're not quite sure why. She did have chronic back pain for a few years, but it seemed to come out of the blue for pretty much everyone. So for those who are fans, it's sort of bad news, sad news. With all the people that die, somehow it just hits you more when they're young or it's unexpected or it comes out of the blue. It sort of hits you more somehow. If she was 96, you'd be like, good long career.
Right. I mean, it's like when John Ritter died. It was quite sudden, quite immediate, and he was young. He was like, I think, in his 50s, maybe even in his 40s.
I don't think he was in his 40s, probably, but maybe in his 50s or 60s. So that's too bad, but life goes on. Our show goes on. Hopefully you're rating and reviewing the show, because we can wait. We'll be happy to wait and let Sperling fend off Leatherface while you rate and review our show.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know what? Actually, if you want to rate and review it, you can go to iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace or Stitcher or anywhere they give podcasts away for free. That's where you can subscribe to our show. Or you can call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Or write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. Or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. It's like the opposite day. We're starting with the end of the show.
That's right. And nobody emailed us or called us to say, hey, happy holidays or happy Martin Luther King Day or happy New Year. So, rate and review the show. Go to iTunes, give us 5 stars and tell us why.
Actually, we did have one person email us to a correction. Should we do it right here at the top of the show?
Sure. I don't even know what it is. I hope it's your correction and not mine.
Actually, it was Joe Gaze, and he writes, hey kids, a small correction from the last show. While discussing the Met story, it was said that the Met would become like the Louvre and Smithsonian and charge a fee. Well, almost all of the Smithsonian's museums are
free.
Yep, but the Louvre charges, however, of course, does have free days. I love the show, which I have already rated and reviewed in iTunes.
Joe Gaze. Thanks very much. That's true. Another friend told me about that, too. I was going to try to mention that at some point, but I appreciate your sending us a note so we make sure people know, hey, the Smithsonian is free. And that's one of the things that makes it great. And that's why the Met should stick with that as well. But anyway, Joe listened to the last show, and I'm sure he's going to listen to this show. What will he hear about?
Well, he's going to hear me say that, when I read that, I thought, I think the Smithsonian is free. But I just kind of read it anyway, thinking, well, Michael must have researched this. But apparently, we were both wrong. Okay, well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got more award season to talk about. The directors and cinematographers have weighed in on their favorites of the year, not to mention the Brits. Pour yourself a cup of tea and let the tea leaf reading begin. You see what I did there? Because you're pouring tea.
Yeah, I got it.
When you finish, you'll have
tea leaves. And it's the Brits. And it's the Brits.
Oh, yes, that's true. Okay. Sadly, the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend did not bring a pause in stories of sexual misconduct. We've got the latest on Eliza Dushku, Catherine Deneuve, and others. On Inside Baseball, we look at streaming TV like Hulu and YouTube, and indeed, even the future of TV in general, where I will make amazingly specific and accurate predictions of what TV watching will be like 20 years in the future. Wait, what? I will? I should read this stuff before I read it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, and so on. And the number one movie, wait, I have another correction. I just remembered. Last week, I think it's fallen off the chart. It's a Russian drama called Vertical, and it was about the 1972 Russian basketball team, the Soviet basketball team at the time, crushing the Americans, ending their 63-game winning streak. And I joked about how, hey, we never hear about that, huh, do we? I imagine if it was our Miracle on Ice, we'd hear about that all the time. Well, what a horrible comparison, since the Miracle on Ice was, of course, a story of amateurs succeeding wonderfully in the spirit of the game, whereas when the Soviets won the Olympic basketball game, beating the Americans, they actually cheated. It was one of the most egregious accounts of cheating in Olympic history. It was unbelievable. It was an international scandal. It was more like the Black Sox, if you're going to compare it to anything. And in fact, it was so egregious, the Americans refused to pick up their silver medal. They're still sitting there unclaimed because it was such an unfair game. So that 1972 Olympic event was memorable, known around the world. I was a little ignorant about it. I'm guessing that this Soviet drama does not really delve into that in the ways that the American fans would prefer.
Wait a second. So you're saying that the Russians cheated?
Yes, apparently.
How did they do that?
Yeah, they did. In Peking, with the judges. The judges and bribery, apparently at the final buzzer, the Russian player like just shoved an American player down off the when he was trying to score and they didn't do anything about it. I mean, it was truly like completely obvious. It wasn't like we've figured this out. It was like this is crazy at the time. They didn't pick up their silver medal. They didn't even go on. I mean, it was, you know, truly egregious. So it's a famous event. I think there's a 30 by 30 about it. On ESPN. I mean, it's a really well-known scandal. So maybe the movie in Russia, you know, goes into that. I don't know.
I think we should remake the movie and do it in English.
From our point of view.
Yeah exactly.
And then we can have them in a film festival played side by side. But anyway, that probably won't happen. And for the moment, if you go to the movies, the number one movie around the world is Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. $108 million worldwide on the weekend. And it's yet another movie to hit that satanic number, $666 million worldwide. Good heavens, is Dwayne Johnson the devil? Big, big success story, though, because it only cost about $90 million to make. There will, of course, be at least two sequels, right?
Yes, I would agree with you. I think we're talking at least two sequels.
That's right. And number two around the world is Star Wars, The Last Jedi. It's slowing down, but it got another $30 million on the weekend. It's grossed $1.2 billion worldwide. It's the highest grossing film released in 2017. It has now passed Beauty and the Beast and whatever else was up there. I think Fast and the Furious 7. But let's put this into context. It's the 10th highest grossing film of all time. Anyone painting this film, which cost maybe $200 million to make, as anything other than a massive success story, is bonkers.
Yeah, it's funny because even people that I've been speaking with, executives, they're like, look, you know, it's a huge success, but they're all looking at those drop-offs every week and they're going, from a story standpoint and from a marketing standpoint, what happened? Because
I don't think anything happened. I think the reviews were fine. I know that people screamed that fans hated it, but they went to see it multiple times. It doesn't make $500 million in North America without being popular.
No, but that is half of what it made, or, you know, 40% of what the last Star Wars film made.
60%.
60%. Okay.
This made $1.2 billion. That one made $2 billion. That is a phenomenon that rarely, it's like saying if the next Avatar movie doesn't make $2 billion worldwide, it's a failure. No, it's not. it's a ridiculous expectation that every movie make the same amount as the movie before. It's the second in a trilogy. It grossed $1.2 billion. Three movies in a row have grossed over $1 billion. It's a huge commercial success.
Here's what I think is a success, okay? When you spend $200 million making something and then you make $1.2 billion on it and, you know, clear, let's say, $500 million in profit. I think that's pretty much a success.
Yeah. And number three around the world is Insidious, The Last Key. $30 million on the weekend, $92 million worldwide. And number four is The Greatest Showman, the Hugh Jackman musical set in the circus. $27 million on the weekend, just under $200 million worldwide. And number five is X-File 3, the Chinese romantic comedy. $24 million on the weekend, $250 million worldwide. That's a big, big success story. I wonder if there'll be an English language remake of that franchise. And number six is Coco, the Pixar animated film. $22 million on the weekend, $620 million worldwide. And number seven is Forever Young. This is a Chinese drama spanning 100 years of history. It cost about $15 million to make. It stars Zhang Ziyi. It grossed $20 million on its opening weekend. But here's the weird thing. It was filmed, at least finished filming, in 2012.
What took them so long to distribute it?
I have no idea. I have tried to figure it out. I don't know why it sat on the shelf. I don't know what they were worried about, if there were political issues or the company went bankrupt, or I haven't been able to figure anything out. So if you know, let us know. Sperling just gave you the contact info, but we'd love to hear why. I looked for it online, but I couldn't figure it out.
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Boom. And number eight is The Post, the Steven Spielberg drama opening wider in North America. $20 million on the weekend. It's now at $25 million. And of course, this is the sort of film that should have long legs. People aren't going to turn out on opening day for an adult drama. They're hoping it will appeal to a wider audience, maybe get some Oscar love, even though it hasn't really gotten a lot of buzz from most other critics groups or certainly the guilds. But, you know, anything's possible. Certainly, I think it'll be a commercial success. And number nine is Liam Neeson's latest actioner. It's The Commuter, which I still think looks like a parody of Liam Neeson action films. But people went. It grossed $20 million on its opening weekend.
If I were, you know, anywhere around Liam Neeson, I would run. Because this guy gets into more trouble. I mean, I know he's a man with a particular set of skills. But you know what? I don't want to be in need of that particular set of skills. And something tells me that if I'm hanging out with Liam Neeson, I might need them.
I'd rather hang out with Ferdinand the Bull, who doesn't really want to fight. He grossed $16 million on the weekend, and his movie is at $207 million worldwide. Gary Oldman's Oscar hopeful Darkest Hour made $15 million on the weekend. That's at $55 million worldwide, and they expect to keep going on throughout Oscar season. And number 12 is Pitch Perfect 3, another $14 million on the weekend, $160 million worldwide for what is probably the third and final film in that series. And number 13, a bit of a disappointment, I think, Paddington 2. This film has gotten exceptionally good reviews. I think in the days of Siskel and Ebert, they would have said two thumbs up, way up. I can't predict they would have liked it, but it's been across the board gotten quite strong reviews. Hugh Grant got, a Brit Award for Us Best Supporting Actor. It's just gotten a lot of love, and it grossed $12 million on the weekend. So it opened in North America, but not very strongly. I don't think they paid a ton of money to pick it up, but it's at $150 million worldwide, well below what the original film made, and that's a shame since it seems to have delivered on the quality of the first one.
Yeah, you know, on film Twitter, if you're hanging out there, certainly this film was, people were loving this film. All the critics were saying, please, please, and they were pleading, go see this movie, Paddington 2. It's so great. And there were threats to any critic that destroyed Paddington 2's 100% Rotten Tomatoes score.
Yeah, well, all you got to do is say, you know, it's decent and it keeps up the score. So should not a high bar. Up next is Proud Mary, which looks like a fun blaxploitation flick. But according to our in-house critic, Aaron Rich, when you go see it, it's kind of dull. Taraji P. Henson stars. It grossed $10 million on the weekend. What can you do? And number 15 is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Another $10 million. That's about to hit $14 million worldwide. Right below that is 1987, When the Day Comes, a Korean drama about the overthrow of that country's military dictatorship. That's now at $40 million and counting. Below that is the Chinese fantasy, Along with the Gods, The Two Worlds. That's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. And then Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, it's Molly's Game. $6.7 million on the weekend, $32 million worldwide. That's doing just fine, I think, even though it did cost $30 million to make. So they really need to triple what they've grossed so far. Not triple, but double? What's the word I want? They need to gross another $60 million. That's what I'm trying to say. And some more Oscar hopefuls. Why not Wonder? Couldn't Wonder get some nomination? Isn't the kid adorable?
Well, it hasn't so far kind of been stirring up that kind of talk.
No, it hasn't. Isn't the kid good, though? Or is it just a blah? It's okay.
No. Actually, the kid is good, but, you know, okay for that kind of movie. So I think...
But he got an Oscar nomination before, didn't he?
Well, that's true.
Yeah, so once an Oscar nominee, always an Oscar nominee. But it's at $230 million worldwide. And finally, at number 20, another big Oscar hopeful, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. $6 million on the weekend, $30 million worldwide. So that wraps up the box office. But I'm more excited by the award season. You know, forget box office. We care about the art.
Yeah, well, actually, the art leads to box office sometimes. I mean, if you get nominated for an Academy Award... Or maybe an ASC prize, you know, by the Cinematographers or Directors Guild Award. Maybe you're, you know, certainly will be in the marketing campaigns. And maybe your box office goes up.
That's right. So who did the cinematographers like? The American Society of Cinematographers announced their nominations for the Best Shot Films of the Year. It's sort of their Best Picture Award in a way. What do they have on tap?
Well, of course, Blade Runner 2049. People may not have seen it, but apparently cinematographers did, and they loved it. So Roger Deakins for Blade Runner 2049, Bruno Delbonnel for Darkest Hour, Hoyt Van Hoytema for Dunkirk, Dan Lauston for The Shape of Water, and Rachel Morrison for Mudbound.
Nice to see a woman in there. But Roger Deakins has been nominated 13 times, and he's never won the Oscar. Could this be the year? I don't think Blade Runner 2049 is necessarily the one to put him over the top, but it's certainly worthy. It's a terrific-looking movie. I'm really rooting for Hoyt, though. Dunkirk, I think, is the best of those five, so I'm hoping he wins.
If it's not going to be Blade Runner 2049, I don't know. Look for The Shape of Water. I'd have to look to see whether Dan Lauston has actually already won a ton of awards. I don't think he's ever won an Academy Award. And if not,
Hoyt has never been nominated either.
Okay, so then they're both up there.
Yeah, they're both would be first time nominees.
Okay.
So there you go. But the directors, they weighed in as well. Their favorite films of the year were Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. That means they've nominated a person of color and a woman.
Who was the woman? Oh, Lady Bird. Okay. Yes.
That's right. Greta Gerwig.
Yes.
And she's also nominated for Best First-Time Director, I believe. Isn't she? No, she's not, actually. There is a little bit of overlap. They have a category for Best First-Time Debut. That's Patty Cakes for Jeremy Jasper. Lady Macbeth, a terrific movie directed by William Oldroyd. Jordan Peele's Get Out. That's the one that hit it up in both categories. Taylor Sheridan for Wind River. And Aaron Sorkin for Molly's Game.
Well, and if you look, you know, what's interesting about the ASC Awards is that Rachel Morrison for Mudbound is a Netflix film and was only in like maybe 18 theaters ever. So for it to be nominated in theatrical releases, that's kind of saying something. As you can see, that did not happen over at the Directors Guild.
That's right. The BAFTAs also had their nominations, and the Brits have good taste. They're not exactly, there is some overlap like the Guild. So I guess it's worthy mentioning for that reason, but there's not a ton of overlap. It's really just another award show that can sort of indicate movies that people are liking and therefore they have a better shot of winning an Oscar. Their nominees for Best Picture are what you might expect. Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards, all of which will probably be in the mix in one shape or another. But Best Director, they threw in a wild card there, and that's Blade Runner 2049, Denis Villeneuve, however one says his name. So he knocked out somebody on that list and stole a Best Director nomination. And like I mentioned before, where is he? Hugh Grant, up for Best Supporting Actor for Paddington 2.
Well, you're beginning to get a picture, no pun intended, of what movies you should be seeing if you want to see some of the better movies that were released last year.
That's right. And if you haven't seen them, don't worry. They'll probably remake them at some point in the future.
Oh, I see what you're trying to do, because we have this kind of like impromptu new, I almost said sequel. I almost said segment is the word I was looking for. But this week in reboot, sequels, and spinoffs.
That's right. We don't really discuss all the reboots, sequels, and spinoffs, just the one that strike us where you go, oh, dear God. Like John Wick. I saw this movie with my friends, I think, on opening weekend with Keanu Reeves. It was a hoot. It had more headshots, and I don't mean actors trying to get work, but like people shot in the head, literally, than I've ever seen in my life. That's the only way he killed people, was shooting them in the head. It was unbelievably violent. It was like a video game. It was hilarious. It was goofy. Not great by any stretch, but it made money. So there's been a sequel, and now they think they have a universe, a franchise. They're spinning off characters and doing it. Now they're going to do a TV series, John Wick, the TV series. There have only been two movies. The second one didn't do that well. What in God's name are they thinking?
I don't know. I mean, because technically they could just use that kind of character persona as its own, you know, as its own character. Why do they need, is there that much name recognition with John Wick that they have
it's
to
more than going? It's more than going with Joe Blow. I'm not questioning why they're remaking it rather than just doing their own assassin hitman guy. Why not use a name people recognize? But I just don't think there's that much worth making a TV series about. It just seems ridiculous.
I mean, even in the movies, John Wick just wanted to be left alone. He didn't want to be bothered by anybody, and he kept being dragged back in, and now you're dragging him back into TV.
Not that the second one didn't make money as well, of course. I mean, I think it cost about $40 million, and it grossed $170 million. So, I mean, I recognize that they're successful. It's just like, dear God, you know, a TV series? Whatever.
Well, as you can see, it's, you know, a holiday weekend. There's not a lot to report on necessarily, but that certainly, as we mentioned earlier, did not stop sexual misconduct news. And so we have a number of stories to tell you about, and I'm hoping that as we move forward, there will be fewer and fewer stories. But here's an interesting one. All the money in the world, which you'd think, wait a second, we already talked about this. Kevin Spacey, we got it. He was, you know, molesting young children, possibly, or not young children, but teenagers, and was, you know, behaving.
That's young children.
Yeah, okay.
13-year-olds are young children.
Behaving poorly. He was excised from All the Money in the World by Ridley Scott. He was replaced by Christopher Plummer. They had to go back and do reshoots. And for that, of course, you have to pay people like the cinematographer, craft services, the camera folks. You got to pay the actors like Michelle Williams. You got to pay her $1,000. Mark Wahlberg, you got to pay him $1.5 million. And then, So here's the deal here. So someone like Mark Wahlberg, huge star, above the title marquee name, in his contracts, he will not have reshoot rights. So if you have
that's funny. You said that, but the Hollywood Reporter said that that would be common.
Oh,
that
really?
There would be a clause in there that like you're doing a Marvel movie, you're definitely set up for reshoots.
Correct.
You're doing a Star Wars movie, you're definitely set up for reshoots. So
well, you're set up for
that you would have some reshoot time set aside.
You're set up for sequels.
No. Reshoots.
Yes.
Hollywood Reporter said that is common in contracts that principal actors be available for reshoots if necessary within a reasonable span and whatever. Obviously, they can't demand, you know, 2 years later you show up for 5 months, but that's sort of a normal part of the thing. It doesn't mean you don't get paid, but it is part of the contracts, and they claimed it was usual and typical.
Yes, depending on the actor, yes. And it depends on how long.
But this is an issue, what's in his contract. This has nothing to do with it. The point is that they rushed out a person. They cut out Kevin Spacey. They wanted to replace him with Christopher Plummer for obvious political reasons and to protect the film. They called everybody on board. You have to pay the below-the-line people their rate. You can't dicker with them. They can't work for free. They're not allowed to. But the big stars have the freedom and ability to say, you know what, this is important. I want to step up to the plate for the film. And that's what Michelle Williams did. They recognized the strange circumstances of this. And she said, I'm available. I'm going to miss Thanksgiving with my child. I'm going to make myself available in any way you want. You can just pay me the per diem day rate, just whatever is the lowest amount available. I know you want to make this happen. I want to make it happen too. I'm available to you. Mark Wahlberg's people, in contrast, said, we've got you over a barrel. He's the highest paid actor of this year, apparently, of 2017, with the numbers of movies he's made and the money he's made and been paid in contracts. He was reportedly already sort of annoyed that he gave such a low quote for the film to begin with. That was just reported in Variety or The Hollywood Reporter. But they just said, hey, you want us available for reshoots? He's got another movie he's making, blah, 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 blah. We want $1.5 million. The problem was they didn't step back and say, wait a second, why are they doing reshoots? What is the context of this? How is this going to look? Why are we trying to score extra money because Kevin Spacey has an alleged child molester? We want to take him out of our movie. They didn't do any of that thinking about the big picture. They just said, we can get more money. We're going to get more money. And yeah. A woman said, I can help you. I think this is important. I will cooperate and collaborate and make this happen.
There I just wonder how much of this Mark Wahlberg actually knew about. In other words, very often you'll find that actors have no idea some of this stuff is going on behind the scenes. That's both good and bad, okay? It's good because they have people fighting for them on their side, and it's bad because they're often completely oblivious to how they're being represented until much later. In this case, I wonder, did Mark Wahlberg know that this was going on? And was,
there's been no indication for him to say, oh, I had no idea, whatever. No, they knew. He wanted money. He was felt like he'd been underpaid. And it's not, they just forgot the context.
Yeah.
They're just stupid. They didn't say, this isn't just we're making Transformers and they want to do some more reshoots and we're going to get our money because you know what? This is a big franchise. This is a Oscar type movie and we're making it for a dime because we want to make the movie and they're doing these reshoots because of this horrific incident and we want to get this other person in the movie so the film isn't wasted completely because all they'll talk about is Kevin Spacey. So they didn't step back and think of the bigger picture and that was stupid of them. And I wrote in the show notes on like this how it happened within a week. On like Wednesday when it came out about this scandal, I wrote, obviously what he should do is donate the fee of $1.5 million to Time's Up and apologize. And in fact, what they did was donate the fee to Time's Up and apologize, as he should have. And William Morris Endeavor paid an extra $500,000 to apologize as well, because she's their client as well.
Yes. Well, and I think yeah, that's true. And I think that's probably the right thing to do.
And it's not that the William Morris Endeavor, well, of course, it's the right thing to do. It would be, PR wise, it's absolutely the right thing to do. And they should not have asked for it in the first place, but they were stupid. But I think the point here was there a collusion between different agents and William Morris screwed her over and did better for him? No, these are two different agents, two different reps, and they aren't communicating, right?
No, that's not necessarily true at all. If they're at the same agency,
they are indeed.
They will most definitely be talking about this. They might not be, you know, sitting in rooms for hours on end talking about it, but a phone call would probably be made and say, you know, hey, what are we doing for, you know, Sony's calling. They need to reshoot this stuff. You know,
so the company knew that she was doing it for basically pro bono and that he was demanding $1.5 million and they didn't think that this would be a problem.
Well,
why are they agreeing to let her do that if they think she should be paid? And why are they letting him do this if they think that's not a smart thing to do? You should not be paid.
Well, because remember, agents and lawyers and managers don't always think that way. And I'm not saying that's correct. I'm saying they work off percentages. And
but
so
that's my point. Why did they let her not demand more money? Because she's a woman? What? Why would they not demand more money for her? Because he brings in more money?
Probably, yes. That's
or because they're just sexist and they don't care about women as much.
Well, and it boils down to also the lawyers and the managers, not the agents, the lawyers and the managers on an account such as Mark Wahlberg, because they're all trying to, you know, everybody jokes, they're feeding at the trough. It's true. They only get paid if Mark Wahlberg gets paid.
That doesn't explain why they didn't demand more money for her. If they want to be paid and they want their money, why didn't they demand more money for her? I'm asking you a question you can't answer, but you're just ignoring the fact that they didn't demand more money from her. They treated her differently than him. Doesn't matter why they did it for him. If they wanted more money because they get a bigger fee, why didn't they do it for her?
I don't know, but I want to call over there and find out.
Well, the LAPD may be making some phone calls as well. They're opening up an investigation into Steven Seagal over sexual assault. Over the weekend or over the holiday week, I guess, multiple women have come forward naming him as a sexual harasser of them personally or a sexual assaulter. Jenny McCarthy did it. She said he tried to bully her into getting nude for an audition for Under Siege 2, even though the role didn't call for it. And then Portia de Rossi, Juliana Margulies, and Inside Edition correspondent Lisa Guerrero also weighed in on Steven Seagal, serious enough accusations that the LAPD is looking into it. But I do know Elijah Dushku. I loved seeing her on Buffy. She's a talented actress, and she had a really terrible story that she came forward with. She says that when she was working as a child on True Lies, the James Cameron film, she was 12 years old, and she was sexually assaulted by the stunt coordinator. His name is Joel Kramer. He denies the charges. He's already been dropped by his agent. Her minder at the time, I'm not sure how to describe this woman. It was a woman with her on the set. I'm not sure if she was her agent or what. She says it's true that Eliza reported to her at the time. She tried to bring it up to authorities and they ignored her about this, which is bizarre to me. It's like, why don't you pull her from the film? But who knows? More of the story will presumably come out. But apparently it happened when she was 12 and she spoke up today. Not just because of the Me Too movement, but because she'd heard in the past that he'd been drummed out of the business, that he'd stopped working. Because he'd been, quote unquote, found out. That was her impression. And obviously she didn't go on IMDb to look him up, because if she had, she would have realized he's still active. He worked on Blade Runner 2049, Speak of the Devil, and Fast and Furious 7. So when she saw that and saw him with a picture on Facebook or something, hugging a small child who was an actress on a film that he was working on, she freaked out and said, I need to speak out and speak up. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this.
Well, Eliza Dushku is kind of a young actress, right? And James Franco, well, I guess we could still consider him, well, I guess he's 40 years old almost, so maybe he's not so young. But there are some allegations against him that kind of surfaced right after he won the Golden Globe last week for The Disaster Artist. And it couldn't come at a worse time for him. Not that necessarily, you know, timing is
award season is not the important thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. You know, he actually is going on talk shows because he has a film to promote and he's talking about it.
Right. You pointed out earlier before the show that that was different from most other people. To you, it gives him a little bit more credibility or a little bit more. I'm not sure what you were trying to say, but it was unusual. And you thought, well, that may be a point in his favor when you're trying to figure out what went on and you want to listen to the people who accuse him of wrongdoing. But of course, you also want to give him a chance to tell his story. But anyway, four women in his acting classes have come forward. They described inappropriate behavior, what they felt was unfair. Some women working on the indie film The Long Home were filming an orgy scene for bonus footage for the movie, which is not unusual. You'll often find racier footage as extras on DVDs and Blu-rays and used for it on cable and the like. They claim James Franco behaved inappropriately while recording sex scenes that were supposed to simulate oral sex. The female casting director for the film immediately spoke up and had a statement and spoke to the press and said she defends the scenes and the treatment of the actors. She says she was there the entire time. She spoke to them. She feels dreadful that they feel uncomfortable, but she was always trying to make clear what was involved, what was going on. Are you comfortable here? Are you comfortable now? Are you comfortable now? She's really distressed that they claim that they were awkward and uncomfortable with what happened. But the acting class that he was a teacher at, that studio has shut down. They closed down last fall. One doesn't know if that's connected. But these women say that he was often asking women to take their shirts off, sending out emails to cast prostitutes for different roles and the like. I have to say, if you know Hollywood, half the roles for women are prostitutes. It's not good or bad, but it's like every woman has played a whore, right? You know, it's just a sad, ridiculous cliche of Hollywood. But, it, you know, and some of the recent films he's done have been sort of involved in the sex world. So that may not be the craziest thing. I'm not trying to defend him. I don't know anything about him. But as with all these cases, you don't want to rush to judgment, but you want to take seriously when people say this stuff and wait to hear the full story to come out and see if other people come forward. And, you know, you learn and listen.
That seemed to be one of those moments where even the journalist covering this story, when interviewed on the radio here in Los Angeles, said, look, you know, he asked each of these women, you know, did he, you know, assault you? And it wasn't an assault so much as, well, I did it because I thought he could advance my career and I was in his class because I thought he could advance my career. But then afterwards, I felt kind of creepy. Well, yeah, okay, but that isn't necessarily misconduct, in my opinion.
Well, if he's trading on his celebrity and the belief that he can help you in order to trick you into paying for a class, that alone is abusive behavior. That alone is being denounced by the Casting Society of America when they say casting directors shouldn't do that, shouldn't get people to pay in the hopes that they're going to be able to further their career just so they can be in front of someone who actually casts TV shows and movies. If you're using that just to hit on women, and well, you know what? You shouldn't do it. It's not nice behavior. Was he doing that? I don't know.
I don't know either.
Right. But we do know that journalists are facing sexual misconduct allegations. James Rosen of Fox News, he left after Fox News began investigating sexual misconduct allegations. He's been there for 18 years. He, of course, says he is innocent and all that. But we'll see if they release any information once those investigations are over. And Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post, he was suspended for 90 days after they did an investigation into conduct of him around female colleagues. But then there's a really confusing story. It's the cat people, the cat woman. Is that the name of that story in the New Yorker?
Oh,
cat person. Cat
yeah,
person.
Yeah, cat person. Yeah, it's
It's a touchstone of the complications and conflicting narratives of people going on a date and having sex and the multiple ways you feel moment to moment when doing that and trying to develop a relationship with someone and maybe not understanding where they're at and what they think this relationship is. We have that for sure with the story of Aziz Ansari, who has responded to sexual misconduct allegations. A woman posting on the website, what's it called?
I don't even know. And you know what? I can't remember.
Babe.net. And she posted a story describing in detail going on a date with him. And describing what she felt was sexual misconduct behavior that she found creepy and unpleasant and disrespectful. You can read the story online. It's a sort of story you read and you go, well, now that's complicated. You know, you want to listen, but again, life is complicated and not everything is clear cut rape and not everything is clear cut sexual harassment or taking advantage of your position of power. Sometimes it's a bad date. Doesn't mean people can't learn from it, but you know, what it means and all that. You've already got like three think pieces about this particular story. The Atlantic has a story talking about, well, hold on a second. There's another story about it. So, you know, this is not even remotely in the category of Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey. And it does not mean, well, if you don't rape you, then it's not that bad. No, but what she describes just sounds like a date where you weren't happy afterwards.
Right.
It doesn't
correct.
Sound like, any, you know, does that trivialize what she says? I don't know. Some people said if men read this story and all they hear is, well, so what? He wanted to have sex and she didn't want to have sex. And so she went home. Then that's part of the rape culture that men expect sex. And some other people say, well, why should women have to be the gatekeeper? Why does she have to be the one to say, I don't want to have sex? To which I say, well, the person who needs to be the gatekeeper is yourself, for yourself. You might be the man with a woman who wants to have sex. You might be the woman with another woman who wants to have sex. You might be the man with another man who wants to have sex and you don't. And, you know, when you're an adult and they don't have power over you and you're just on a date, well, it's your responsibility, the gatekeeper, because who the hell else can do it for you? Again, that doesn't mean to say she'd felt bad and didn't like the date and feels, you know, of course, but trying to pin that to this feels like a bit of a stretch.
Yes, this is actually one of the more disturbing stories of the week to me, because this is exactly where I thought this was headed, which is now you have basically what were supposed to be intimate and private moments being dragged out into the public, and someone like Aziz Ansari has no say over it. Okay, this is, you know, a questionable situation, and by questionable, I don't mean, oh, gee, he's assaulting this woman. No, he's out on a date with this woman. She didn't say no. He thought she meant, yeah, you know, this is just one of those things where if I were Aziz Ansari, I might never date again. Because how do I know the next person isn't going to, like, you know, write a book?
Well, the irony there, of course, is that his shtick is that he is a man who is so woke to women's needs and so respectful of women, that's why he can't get a date. That's sort of part of his stand-up routine back in the day that sort of helped him rise to prominence, which makes the fact, it's like having Alan Alda be accused of sexual harassment or assault. You're like, what? Alan Alda? You know, he's sort of the nice guy that's
right.
Supposed to respect women, which makes this all the more complicated. But here's my point that I'd like to say, however much I may have screwed up describing her perspective and his perspective and that these things matter, even if they don't rise to harassment, assault, or rape. Of course they do, but don't worry about saying, oh, look, this is what Me Too is leading to. It's too much. No, it's like any single individual may make a false accusation or they may lie or someone may conflate a bad date with rape or may conflate rejection with cruelty or so what. None of that undermines the importance of the topic of sexual misconduct. Things will come up that don't fall in that category. People disagree on lots of other things, and most of them are pretty damn clear cut. 98% of what we hear about on here is like a boss harassing an employee or somebody raping somebody or somebody using their power over them or attacking a minor. You know, these aren't really complicated. So most of it is not this difficult to understand. And I wouldn't worry about somebody writing this story on a website I've never heard of somehow poisoning the atmosphere and therefore nobody can date again.
Well, what did you think of what Catherine Deneuve and 100 other French women had to say? Because they're saying, you know what? Whatever happened to flirting? You know, now you're basically, you know, everybody who looks at you the wrong way is you know, sexually assaulting you.
Right.
So
exactly.
Enough
they're
is
so
enough.
French. So French. They're like, oh, such a fuss. So a man put his hand on your knee. Grow up. The problem was that they did have this piece. A lot of the women on there are like Deneuve, but then there are some others who are more conservative and right wing, and they are describing their attitude in ways that Catherine Deneuve does not agree with. And suddenly she found herself sort of being described as denouncing the Me Too movement. Here's Silvio Berlusconi, a pig, applauding her comments, and she's like, oh, dear God. So now she has released another statement. She has denounced the people who supported her. She's apologized to the people who criticized her, and yet she stood by her initial statement. She said, what I said is what I meant, and the other people signed on there try to twist it differently. That's not what I meant. I never meant to downgrade sexual assault and harassment. That's never right. And she says, hey, look, I've been a friend of feminists and women for a long time. She said, I came out in public in 71, signing a feminist statement in which she acknowledged she'd had an abortion. And that was at a time when doing so was still illegal in France. And she liked to say, quote, "I would like to say to conservatives, racists, and traditionalists of all kinds who have found it strategic to support me that I am not fooled. They will have neither my gratitude nor my friendship. On the contrary," end quote. So she wants to say, "I know how you all thought what I meant, but it's not what I meant."
Yeah, so you know, again, she's always such an interesting person to speak with. And whenever she's talking at Cannes and everything, well, she's always talking. She's always at Cannes, let's face it. You know, and she's it's always fascinating to hear her because she's so blunt and she's so French. It's great.
The one time I sat with her, it was 9 a.m. and she was smoking espresso and drinking an espresso. So that says it all. But there are some good things to come out of this. Dan Harmon, the creator of Community and other shows, he has apologized publicly to writer Megan Gans. It's kind of a happy story, despite the sad things that happened to make it begin. She worked on Community and had a very unhappy experience. And at the end of this year, 2017, he posted something saying, "Hey, it's been a terrible year for the treatment of women. I hope 2018 is better." And she was like, "Really? You want to get more specific?" She did that publicly. And he said, "Yes, I do." And he said he'd spoken on his podcast about his poor behavior and how bad he felt about it. But he didn't want to talk about her specifically because he didn't feel like he had the right to drag her name into the public with what he'd done. They had back and forth privately. They had a back and forth publicly. He recorded another podcast where he made a really explicit and complete apology and detailed exactly what he did. He said what happened was he was her boss. He asked her out on a date. And when she said no, she said he treated her progressively worse and worse and more cruelly. He said he was really mean to her and he was a really bad person. And he apologized, and she said she accepts his apology as complete and sincere. And she said, most of all, it was just a relief to hear him confirm what happened. You know, because no matter what else went on, no matter how many people said, "Oh, my God, he was so wrong. You were so right." She's like, "Well, you weren't there. You didn't hear what he said. I'm the only one who knows what he's the only one who can tell me, yes, you're not crazy. I did do that. I was a jerk." And that's what he did. He detailed completely what he did and said he was a jerk after a little bit of back and forth. So they had a private exchange. He did his podcast. She listened to it. She thanked him privately. And then she said, "You know what? I need to do that publicly because it'd be nice to know that when you do something good and you apologize and you try to move forward and grow, that some good thing can come out of it." And she said, "You know, look, women are not different creatures from men. They don't need to be extra careful around us. They just need to treat us with the same basic respect and dignity that they show to other men. You know, this is not the end of the world. You can still have lives." The problem was not that he asked her out on a date, even though that would be an issue for power and work. She says the problem was how we treated her after she said no.
Well, and that's always the thing. You know, a lot of these women are saying, look, it's not necessarily, you know, the actual act in that moment. It's the, you know, for years wondering, well, because I said no, does that mean, is this the reason why I didn't get that job or that raise or that promotion? You know, the unknowing is the problem. The not knowing is the problem.
And she knew precisely how he treated her after she said no, which was horribly. He didn't say, "Oh, okay, you know, let's be friends or whatever," and behave like an adult. He behaved like a jerk. So she knew she was being punished for years on that show. And of course, like you say, she devalued her own work. Was I good enough? Did I only get the job because he wanted to date me or thought he might want to date me? And she was afraid to speak out because if she did, people would say, "Oh, you only got that job because he wanted to date you, or you're only trying to make a name for yourself by bringing it up." So it just really screws you up in the head for quite a while. And she really felt a big relief. You know, people talk about how brave people are for coming out and speaking up. I also think they're really brave when they just deal with it and move on and build a career for themselves. All these talented, successful women who had horrible things happen to them throughout their career, and they developed a thick skin and they fought and they didn't go public with it, which is really hard. I think they'll find, like, kind of, it's a weird comparison, but coming out, like, when you tell people and you get it off, the things you worry about that you think might happen, usually it's such a relief and such a positive thing to be honest and open about things that the hard part really is keeping it in. And hopefully more and more people will realize they can be listened to and people will hear them and that they don't need to keep it in any longer.
Well, I thought what Megan Gans had to say about kind of forgiving Dan Harmon was actually quite interesting, because she said, look, you know, if we're going to publicly go out there and shame these people, then when they do apologize properly, then we do have to publicly make amends with them and publicly kind of say, look, restitution has been made. And you know, they have maybe not financially, but, you know, they have, there is some forgiveness here. There is redemption.
Yeah, you know, it's I'm sure she'd rather it didn't happen in the first place. But, you know, it's a big deal when someone can apologize and when someone else can accept that in the sincere effort it was meant, and that they can perhaps grow and move on. She said, he's a work in process. I'm a work in process. You know, maybe we can get better.
Well, since you did use those two words, deal and big, and not necessarily in that order, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Radiohead's people are talking to Lana Del Rey's people, and it's getting kind of creepy. The song Get Free on her new album contains a lot of musical ideas from Radiohead's breakthrough number Creep. Del Rey has said Radiohead's song absolutely did not inspire her song, but nonetheless, she has offered their music publishing reps up to 40% of the rights to the song during protracted negotiations. The issue has not been resolved, though Radiohead's people keep saying they haven't sued yet. Del Rey says she sure feels like she's being sued. Funny thing about Creep, though, it was successfully sued by the songwriters behind the classic Hollies tune, The Air That I Breathe. And the Hollies actually won a cut of royalties for Creep and songwriting credit. So the Hollies led to Radiohead, which led to Lana Del Rey. And only the lawyers are really happy here. Big deal or big whoop?
Ah, it's a big whoop. These things just go on all the time. Can anything be original? You know, can't a person use the same minor keyed chord progression, rhythm, vocal delivery, tempo, and most of the melody as another song without being accused of copyright infringement? Come on, people.
Oh my God, However, you stole my joke.
However, I will say that Lana Del Rey, she said, it didn't inspire me at all, but I'll give you 40% of my publishing. It's like, really? Like, if it didn't inspire and you don't think they have a case, why the heck would you agree to give them 40%? Who knows?
Well, you know, that's the end of a long, you know, you don't know where that started and you don't know how that, you know, we know where it wound up at 40%, but you don't know how long that's been going on and the harangue. Okay. And it might have just been like, you know what? You will spend so much time in court if you want to do this.
I'm never agreeing to that. I mean, then you'd be agreeing to 1,000 different charges of plagiarism, so it would never end. You have to fight it if you don't feel it's valid. You have to. It's cheaper to fight it than to pay up.
Well, I just wondered, do the Hollies get part of the credit for her song too?
Well, that may very well be, because they are on the credits for Creep.
Well, what's interesting is if you actually listen to all of these songs, and you can do that, just search on YouTube, and there's like 1,000 different, you know, people like have kind of butted the songs up together. They all do sound very similar.
There you go.
You know, Google is tired of getting gypped when it tries to buy tickets to Hamilton. Yeah, join the club. And now the web search company is doing something about it. They're vetting the sites that offer tickets to Hamilton and other Broadway shows, demanding those sites meet certain criteria. They need to clearly mark themselves as resellers and not official sites. No more Rodgers and Hammerstein Broadway.com, thank you very much. They have to also make clear they're charging more than face value, and they have to detail the total cost before people begin purchasing tickets. Maybe now Larry Page can get good seats and be in the room.
Stop, don't say it.
Where it happens. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal, but I don't understand why they're doing this for Broadway tickets and not every other reselling thing in the world. I mean, where does it end? Why not all theater tickets? Why not all concert tickets? Why not all, you know, it's like, okay, you've opened the door to this. Now what?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't know, but I've always been kind of annoyed that Ticketmaster is always showing you tickets that they're like, no, these are just resale tickets. And my question is, well, it's sold out and you're the only person selling tickets to it, but ironically, all the tickets are resale tickets. You know, no conflict of interest there, huh? But, you know, it's been that way for years and nobody's been able to do anything about it. Now, speaking of music, Jimmy Iovine dismissed rumors he was quitting Apple and seemed especially peeved everyone thought it was money. He said, yes, some of his shares vest in August, but it's just the last bit, which, by the way, is exactly how those contracts work. You know, they work in four-year increments and you get 25% each year. Iovine says it's not about the money, which is easy to believe when someone is worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He said Apple Music is at 30 million subscribers and Beats is doing great, but there's a lot of work to be done. Iovine also said music labels are waiting for streaming to save them the way CDs did years ago, but that might not happen this time, even if streaming starts to scale. That is, adds tens of millions or hundreds of millions more subscribers. His big complaint, by the way, Netflix and Amazon and Hulu have tons of original content, but music streamers have none. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, he's wrong, which I find a little bit bizarre, because we know that every time Tidal or Apple or somebody else has an exclusive for a week or a long time, like Jay-Z's album, I don't think I've heard yet because it's only on Tidal. Well, people get really annoyed about it. It's sort of a weird, interesting thing. If Apple has an original TV show or Amazon or Netflix, people don't get upset. But when a superstar artist releases a new album, you expect to be able to hear it. You know, just like you used to be able to buy it in the store, you expect to be able to hear it on your streaming service. And people don't like it when it's exclusive to just one of them. So A, he's wrong about that. And B, people don't actually like it when you do it. So I think it's a big deal. I wasn't quite sure why he was leaving. I didn't think the work of him and Dr. Dre was done. So it makes sense that they would hang out. And by the way, we just got a late breaking news story that Joel Kramer, the stunt coordinator accused of sexually assaulting Eliza Dushku when she was 12, is the subject of two further allegations of misconduct, both reported on Deadline.com. One involves a stunt woman, Laura Albert, who said that he coerced a 16-year-old girl, the friend of her younger sister, into having sex while he was working on Virus, and another account as well. So more information is coming out, unfortunately, about Kramer. And the fact that he was dropped so quickly by his people, you wonder whether they were cowards or whether they knew something and knew the guy was kind of trouble and, you know, jumped ship because they knew they should have jumped ship a long time ago.
Who knows? But let's move on with our next story, and not to make light of that, but we do have lots of stories to get to. Now, with football streaming on Twitter and Facebook, creating original streaming content, the convergence of media and tech is creating a lot of unintended consequences. Now, you may be asking, such as what? Well, such as finding it harder and harder to name people to your company's board of directors that you're not competing with. That's the
first world problems.
Exactly. Well, it's a problem faced by Disney, and their solution? Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook and Jack Dorsey of Twitter are stepping down from Disney's board of directors. And Disney says, given our evolving business and the businesses Ms. Sandberg and Mr. Dorsey are in, it has become increasingly difficult for them to avoid conflicts relating to board matters. Big deal or big whoop?
I would just like to say that if they're not going to invest in our podcast, we would be happy to sit on the board of Disney.
Yes, I'm more than happy to do that, provided I get a silver pass and can go to Disneyland whenever I'd like.
That's the thing. I don't understand how someone like the head of Facebook and Twitter have time to be on the board of another major corporation. I've never understood that. Like, aren't they busy people?
But, well, that's always been the issue, right? That's always been a question that people
have. It just seems like friends scratching other friends' back and they get another six or seven figures for sitting on a board.
Correct.
And they approve your salary so you can approve their salary and they all make more money than God.
Right. Well, and who knows, because God has not released his or her tax returns. Logan Paul is hugely popular on YouTube. He's a popular YouTuber, as the millennials like to say. When he went to a forest in Japan known for being a tragically popular site for suicides, Paul stumbled across a dead body and then made fun of it and posted that on YouTube. He has since... Bad idea. He has since removed it and apologized for being basically a doofus and inconsiderate and promises to learn from his mistake. But that's not enough. YouTube has pulled back from their support of him in various ways, yanking him from their Google Preferred program, cutting him from season 4 of the YouTube Red comedy series Foursome, and otherwise making him persona non grata. YouTube was initially criticized for taking so long to react to the controversy. Big deal or big whoop?
That's the thing I like to focus on. They took too long. They took 11 days to act. And I guess that's considered too long. Like, catching your breath, hearing him out, putting it in context, seeing, you know, it's like the idea of actually taking more than 40 seconds to react and say, I denounce you, seems to be a lost art. I'm not saying they didn't take too long or took too short. You release a statement saying, hey, we're concerned and we're looking into it. But, you know, 11 days, really? Is that too long to make a decision that affects somebody's life? Dear God.
Well, in these days, what Catherine Deneuve said in her letter and in her interview since, you know, social media dogpiles, you know, it's you expect a quick response, you know, that verdict better be in, you know, by the end of the next 5 minutes.
And I don't want to forgive or whatever this idiot and what he did. It sounded tasteless and awful, but like, dear God, like, I never want to see him again. It's like, you know, like, he did a stupid thing. Like, does that, you know, it wasn't, didn't seem like an evil thing where, like, that other guy was, you know, promoting anti-Semitic stuff. It just seemed like unbelievably tasteless and dumb. But, you know, oh, dude, there's a body, whatever. It just is all unpleasant. Both his stupid comment and action and the insane overreaction as if he was Charles Manson. You know?
Well, he is an insanely popular YouTuber, as you point out. And he is, you know, if you saw the video, and it was so crass and just, I mean, he is crass to begin with. So then putting him in that situation, it was just not done very well.
It's like expecting the guys at Jackass to tour like a Holocaust memorial and do a good job of it.
Correct. Exactly. Okay. That's actually not a bad analogy.
Okay.
Now, ABC's big hit Modern Family, it keeps rolling along. The record.
Stop! Stop!
What?
That's what I say. No, ABC's Modern Family. Stop already. Okay.
The record-setting Emmy winner just aired its 200th episode. The Big Bang Theory is another long-running hit, but with the way shows are monetized, are long-running network sitcoms worth all the money? Fewer seasons and fewer episodes per season seem to be the wave of the future, so maybe the likes of Modern Family and Big Bang will become more rare. But some things never change. The show will end after its 10th season, and ABC is still pushing for a spinoff. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. I'm not sure it's the end of long-running shows. I don't know. Maybe the numbers just don't make sense anymore. You're not trying to reach syndication, but doesn't syndication still churn out a lot of money?
You don't need that
100 episodes. Yeah.
Overseas, it does. So you're right.
Yeah. I mean, I still think there's a lot of value in having 100 plus episodes of a show. Maybe 200 is really where it becomes ridiculously unnecessary, but you want to be able to strip it 5 days a week and not have too many reruns in there. I don't know.
Lot of the reruns run on those 15th, you know, NBC channel, you know, and a lot of those channels will be going away.
Right. I mean, local access, I guess, is not the same anymore, local TV stations. But you look at like the value that Hulu got out of Seinfeld, the tons of viewing they got for all those episodes. You think maybe there's still value in having a big library with a lot of episodes. People don't want to power through a show in, you know, 3 days. If it takes them 3 weeks, that's actually maybe worth something. And that segues us right into Inside Baseball, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And last week we talked about streaming music, and this week we're looking at streaming TV and movie companies.
That's right. Right up the bat is Hulu. Hulu announced their subscribers have hit 17 million. That's a big metric for them. They're very happy about that. You want to compare it, however, they've got 17 million subscribers. Netflix has 110 million subscribers. So about roughly, almost 100 million more. But they have $1 billion in gross revenues, and they have a lot of other good stories to tell. They have 1,700 TV shows containing 75,000 episodes. They claim that is double what Netflix or Amazon have, but I'm not clear what metric they're using there. But they got a lot of TV shows. That's basically what they're trying to say.
Well, let's not forget, they were founded by Fox, Universal, and Disney. Okay? Or was Disney, or did Disney buy in? It was
It was CBS that held out, right?
It was CBS that held out. So yes, it was Disney because of ABC, right? Yeah. So that's what it was. And you know, at the end of the day, they've got all these television shows, and you've got people who are wanting to jump from cable or satellite. They want to cut the cord, and all of a sudden, Hulu has this like Hulu Lite, where you get like 40 channels, and it's not $190 per month. And it's looking a lot more attractive. It's obviously working.
So they've got a skinny bundle that they're offering?
Yes, they do. As does YouTube, by the way.
Does it live prime time?
I don't know about live. I wouldn't be shocked if it was live, but I do know that it's, you know, fast follow, where, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it shows on a Tuesday at 8, and by Tuesday at 10:30, it's already available.
Interesting. So they have lots of other good stories to tell. The Handmaid's Tale is their signature show, sort of like The Sopranos back in the day for HBO, or House of Cards for Netflix. And Seinfeld, they're getting lots of rerun rights. Seinfeld got onto Hulu, and they say that has hit 65 million hours of consumption. People watching Hulu have spent a total of 65 million hours watching Seinfeld. That doesn't even seem possible to me.
And you want to know why Americans are so fat? There you go.
They've got George Clooney. They signed him up for his TV series, or really mini series. There's not going to be, you know, a second season to Catch 22. They've got that. They landed that show, which was a hot property. They also got Clooney's ER. that show's reruns are coming to Hulu. So they're building up their library. And unlike, I guess, Netflix, they're thinking there's still a game to be played in reruns of network shows because they are the networks. Therefore, they don't have to worry about themselves pulling it away from them.
Right. And as I just mentioned, you know, all those reruns, they're presently, and for a long time, they had been on kind of the local stations, as you mentioned, Michael. And then as cable proliferated and we had 500 channels, they would be on TNT and then they'd move
TBS
off,
and they'd be on, yeah.
And then they'd move off to like, you know, NBC4, you know, like the fourth or ABC HD, you know, 283 or, you know, so all of these kind of like secondary or third networks or third channels that the big broadcasters were getting carriage fees for. However, now all of the MVNOs, I think that's a telecom term, but basically the cable providers, they don't want to pay that. They don't want to pay for every last channel because subscribers
nobody's watching them. Yeah.
And subscribers don't want to pay for it. Yeah, okay, they might want to pay for ESPN, they might want to pay for CNN or Fox News, but they don't want to pay for Reels, R-E-E-L-Z, because you know what? Nobody's watching it. And so that's going to go away. And instead, all of these broadcasters are going to have to start making content for their own streaming services. Disney has figured this out.
Well, I don't know if they've figured it out. It seems obvious, but I'm not sure where it's all going to end. But I'm sure we're going to see some lawsuits because you've got, you know, NBC Universal self-dealing to Hulu reruns of ER. Did they get the right amount for it? Did they give themselves a discount so that they can monetize it via their piece of Hulu? And do all the people who have a piece of ER, are they happy with the price that was paid? Because, you know, when you're self-dealing, it's very hard to get a good price. And it's very hard for people not to feel like you should have gotten more.
Okay, well, let's use ER as an example. Okay, and follow me here, all right? ER was made in the 1990s, okay? And that was when you knew there was going to be, if you hit 100 episodes, you'd get into syndication, okay? And you'd go to the local stations. So you'd go to Channel 11, you know, these are stations that aren't national. And then eventually you'd make it to TBS or TNT or one of these, you know, kind of cable networks. And then mm-hmm. you'd make it to the secondary cable networks, you know, 10 years out. And there were multiple ways to monetize these reruns. In fact, to such a point where sometimes you lost money on the initial airing of a show, knowing that down the line you would kind of break even and make money. That said, if you were starring in one of those shows or you had directed, you would earn a fee or a royalty every time another sale was made.
Yeah, there's tons of money to be made if you're a creator or principal involved in a TV show. It's got 300 plus episodes. It aired for 15 seasons. It was one of the biggest hits of all time.
Correct. And so you look at John Wells and Michael Crichton's estate and, you know, there were payday or even Seinfeld and there were paydays every time it hit another syndication level.
Yes.
However, let's look at what's happening now and moving forward. So that was then, this is now. You have The Handmaid's Tale, okay? Imagine if ER was The Handmaid's Tale and Hulu decided they wanted to make ER, okay? And it was going to be the first time it ever aired. They basically pay everybody once. And they never have to pay royalties because there's never another monetization scheme for it. It's just a subscription. You get your fee. And this is what agents are talking about.
But doesn't it get sold all over the world?
On their own platforms, yes.
Only Hulu is all over the world?
Hulu is not all over the world.
Right.
However, it is now branching off into other territories. Netflix is all over the world. Disney plans to be all over the world. Amazon is all over the world. Apple most certainly is all over the world. And what these agents and managers and lawyers are saying is it used to be you'd get paid once when you did the film or the television show. And then eventually
and then again and again and again on reruns and all that.
Right. And of course, the checks got smaller and smaller and smaller, no doubt. But you would at least kind of have, you know, recurring revenue that was declining for everything that you did.
And if you were a creator, you got another piece when it got sold into syndication. That was a big payday.
Correct. Especially the first syndication. However, now you do Handmaid's Tale and you do your part in it or you know direct your episode or you're the creator and that's it. You don't get any royalties because there's no royalties to get.
So what's your point? That is that why actors are getting more upfront? Is that why an episode of American Gods on Stars cost $10 million to make? Because everyone said, hey, I know I'm not getting any more money after this, and I know you're going to make money on it for a long time to come, so I better get my payday now.
I think that's part of it. I also think you're seeing, you know, the NBC Universals of the world, the Foxes of the world. They're like looking at this and going, you know what? Actually, this is not a bad model. We could just kind of...
But there's no other payday because there's no other way for them to make money. It's just on Hulu. If people don't subscribe to Hulu, they've got a show sitting there and they're not making money. They only have the monthly subscription of Hulu, as opposed to 10 different levels of making money by selling it on DVD and Blu-ray, by selling to local TV stations, and then selling to syndication and selling to country after country all over the world. All that revenue streams are gone for them. So it's dried up for them just as it has for the actors.
Well, yeah, but I guess what they're looking at, and Disney is looking at specifically, and I keep going back to Disney because they're about to get into this business, is do we want, let's say, $10 from 40 million people every single month for who knows how long? Or do we want them to pay once and then again and again, and we might get them again, we may not get them again? In other words, it's better to have that recurring revenue, and I think that's the thinking.
Well, there are pay TV subscribers all over the world. People paying for TV in any way has hit 1 billion people. 1 billion, 73 million people around the world offer up some money monthly to access television. That's the third quarter of 2017. I think it's a new record. Over people, one out of eight on the planet, are paying to access television. Maybe they're just paying a Netflix account, or maybe they got a $150 a month bill like you do. I don't know.
Well, or as Mark Zuckerberg said, only a billion? You know what's cool? 2 billion users.
Well, so you're looking at it from the business point of view of who's going to get paid when and where. My question is just, how are people going to watch TV?
How are people?
Are they literally all going to just, is on demand the wave of the future? Because I just don't see people lining up at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday to watch a show.
On demand is most definitely the wave of the future.
And shows will just become popular and people will hear about it. And 3 months later, somebody else will start to play Stranger Things.
Correct.
People today are discovering that show. Or, the end of the effing world. People will, over the next 6 months or a year or 5 years from now, go, oh my God, there's that show. And they'll discover it. All these other shows that are out there. So many shows you feel like, wow, there's too many. How can people discover them all? You also think, can they really monetize all of them? But I guess if they think they're making money off monthly subscriptions and that's all they need, it'll work for them. But people are not going to have 30 apps that they pay for every month, are they? They're not going to pay $5 a month for 30 different apps. But gee, Disney, the CBS ones, you can get Star Trek, ESPN, HBO, it adds up damn quick.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think, 10 years from now, when we're all paying $150 to have Hulu, Disney, Netflix, Amazon, and HBO, I think we're going to be crying in our soup.
Yes, exactly. We're not going to want a skinny bundle. We're going to want a fat bundle. We just want it to be less than all those darn apps.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not the apps so much as the apps is kind of the method of delivery. It's the service, really, that you're talking about.
Well, the cost of accessing the TV you want to watch.
Right.
And the people who say, gee, I hate all these 500 channels, it's a waste of money. Actually, you were accessing a lot of good TV, and now you're paying for it channel by channel, and that menu of options is not so good.
Yeah, and I think that actually the way that the marketing for these shows will be drawn out is Crashing, for instance, was just on the first season was last year. The second season started again this weekend, and there was lots of interviews of I think his name is Pete Hamill, the star of the show. And so all of a sudden I went back and said, you know what, I never watched the first season. Let me watch the first couple of episodes. Well, that's how that...
How was it?
It's okay. It's a little, I saw the first two episodes. I'm going to go back and maybe watch the third or fourth, but I'm not racing back.
All right. Yeah. And I think that's going to be the way of reporting on TV and covering TV has to change and adapt to the times because, the second a show drops is not the only time you need to pay attention.
Well, speaking of reporting on TV, we report on TV every single week. We also report on movies and music and... Well, what else do we report on? Books? There was no book filter segment this week. I'm not sure why.
Because my laptop is broken again.
Oh, okay.
It hasn't been fixed, and I have to take it back in. I haven't had it all week. I couldn't do my picks, so I didn't know what's going on.
No books were published during the past week at all. So don't go to the library. Well, actually, you know what? If you don't want to miss out on any of the stories that we report on, then subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You should be able to download our show, rate and review our show. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Ways to subscribe to us, as I mentioned. Ways to call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
John Wick Forever.
Okay, well, I don't think they necessarily have that show shot yet, but in the meantime, why not head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com, where you can find out most weeks what books you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.